says, I wore my science tie today, he says, according to Bloomberg, what the judge said.
I wore my what?
I wore my science tie, he said.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of March 22nd, the beginning of spring 2018. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Very well. And we are also joined by our frequent guest, Ms. Mariah Tinker. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm well. How are you?
Good, 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 good. So, interesting set of events this week. Interesting questions, I suppose I should say. Let me set it up, and I'll throw it to one of you two guys. Out in California, there are, well, actually across the country, there are a bunch of U.S. cities suing the fossil fuel, the big fossil fuel companies like Exxon, etc., for damages caused by climate change. So think New York City being damaged in Hurricane Sandy and saying, well, Hurricane Sandy was at least exacerbated by climate change, and that's because the bad guys at Exxon knew about it and sold everybody fossil fuels, and they are now liable for some degree of the damage, to pay for some degree of damage in New York City. That kind of theory writ large, I think, is underpinning the case. It's happening, the case itself is happening out on the West Coast, and the case seems to have ended up at the bench of a very, I guess, a likable kind of judge, more you read about it. But the judge in this case has done something a little bit out of the ordinary. So, let me put it in your court. Did I get the setup correct? And what did the judge decide to try and do?
This is referring to lawsuits brought by San Francisco and Oakland against BP, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, Exxon, and Shell, basically alleging that those five big oil companies are responsible for the damage that San Francisco and Oakland are suffering as a result of climate change because according to San Francisco and Oakland, they knew and basically blocked any efforts to reduce emissions. So as a result of that, the judge in the case, I believe his name is William Alsup, who's a Clinton appointee, wanted a tutorial in which he asked attorneys for the plaintiffs and the defendants to basically explain, the background and the history of climate science.
Do you know, D.R., I know you're a bit of a legal, was this not part of the trial proper, but this is some official action before the trial began to educate the judge?
In essence, it was a preliminary hearing prior to the various further developments in the trial, in which the judge basically wanted to establish, a factual baseline of what is going to be discussed in this trial. So he just wanted to see, is there any kind of point of agreement between attorneys for the plaintiffs and attorneys for the defendants as to the basics of the science.
Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that the fossil fuel companies have filed a motion to dismiss the lawsuit, saying that Oakland and San Francisco the claims that Oakland and San Francisco made that, they cause fossil fuel damages that are, swallowing up their cities and causing damage to the cities. Mm-hmm. There's no basis in that. Mm-hmm. And so the judge said, well, I want to hear this tutorial, and then he's going to hear the motion that the fossil fuel companies filed to dismiss the case. He'll hear it at a hearing next month after the tutorial. And I think, interestingly, the tutorial, it sounds like the tutorial has two parts. And the first is that each side, San Francisco and Oakland versus the oil companies, gets to have a 60-minute presentation on the history of the study of climate change. Mm-hmm. And then the second part was a bunch of the parties were presenting the best available science they have on global warming, melting sea ice and sea level rise, as well as coastal flooding, where either attorneys or experts could participate. Mm-hmm. And so he's getting both sort of the legal presentation and then the scientific presentation.
I guess for climate change. An interesting way to proceed, because I think there's legal mechanisms of, you know, stipulating to certain facts and stuff like that that you would do in these kind of cases as well, right? Where if both sides agree that, you know, John Doe got killed on a certain date, well, even without agreeing as to who killed him, right? That they all say, oh, yeah, this is a fact. We don't have to argue about that kind of thing in a court case. It seems like, I guess I'm interested as to why the judge would have chosen a path of this kind of tutorial as opposed to having them submit briefs. Maybe he's an auditory learner and wants to hear it instead of having to read a textbook.
And the interesting thing is that according to Grist, in this tutorial, the defendant's an attorney for Chevron, who I guess is sort of taking the lead in terms of the defendants. They largely agreed with the background of the science. In fact, Grist noted that the attorney for Chevron quoted at length from various IPCC reports. But basically, the argument that's being made by the defendants is that, in essence, the public wanted the fossil fuel-based energy that these oil companies were providing. So it's basically the public that's ultimately responsible for the damage caused by climate change, not necessarily the suppliers. It's the users of the products, not the suppliers, who should be held responsible. I guess that's the argument that the defendants are trying to advance in this case.
So interestingly, I mean, we talked a little bit about this. Does, you know, when we were talking about the Juliana versus the United States case and about how having that case would be a good place to get a bunch of scientific information about climate change on record, so to speak. Is this doing that same thing, or is there a need for that to be done? Has that already been done somewhere?
That's a good question. And of course, according to Grist is, you know, they're basically calling it the showdown that wasn't. And they're basically saying that, you know, this is one of the first times that in a courtroom, big oil representatives are basically saying, yes, the science is clear, the science is good. They're just trying to sort of do this sort of spin and basically say, hey, don't blame us for providing the dirty energy that the people essentially wanted. So it's very similar to some of the rhetoric we've specifically heard from Exxon over the years, where Exxon, you know, now acknowledges that it's for real, but you all have various Exxon representatives basically saying, hey, all we were doing was giving the public what they wanted, so don't put it on us, essentially.
I wonder if that's going to come back to bite Exxon, though, because if they're now saying, well, yes, we know that the science is real and, you know, that the climate is warming and it's caused by humans. So then when it kind of turns around and people say, but you were publishing things, and I forget where it was, the New York Times or something, where they had all these advertisements that were casting doubt on the climate science. If they're now admitting that in court, that they actually agree that the science is sound, is that going to come back to haunt them? Because there's plenty of cases.
I mean, I think that even if you knowingly sell a dangerous product, I mean, think of the cigarette guys, right? I mean, they knew that it's completely analogous, right? Cigarette smokers kept buying the cigarettes. Right, so the tobacco company kept selling it. So who's morally responsible? Is it the person selling the bad, the dangerous product, or the person who's demanding it? And I agree with you, Mariah. I think that they're putting themselves in a very strange spot to admit to the inherent, if this is what they've done, because I haven't read what they actually said, but if they've admit to the inherent danger of the product, they got that's a dangerous place to be, because then they quote-unquote own everything that would flow from that.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, you know, is there some element of this where this might be far-fetched, but the fossil fuel companies don't want to talk about the science in a court case, so they're like, it exists, but they don't want to get all the details down in a court case where, you know, whether it's on record, so to speak. So they're just going to kind of sweepingly say, you know, human activities are the main driver of the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and the resulting warming. And they're just going to leave that sentence there, and there's no specifics. So they're not beholden to any of the specifics if they're not on record.
That's an interesting point. And going back to the point about could they be on the hook legally if they basically say, yeah, you know, we knew this stuff all along. And yet when people bring up the fact that, you know, the whole Exxon knew matter, you do wonder, and based on who the judges are, maybe not this particular judge, but, you know, the judges on the Supreme Court, you do wonder if Big Oil were to argue, hey, yeah, we put out disinformation. The people wanted disinformation. Look how many times people want disinformation. If people didn't want disinformation, Fox News would have no viewers, for example. And could you imagine?
Talk to the people at Cambridge Analytica, right?
Yeah, and could you imagine five justices in the U.S. Supreme Court if this appeal gets all the way up there, and the issue of disinformation being promoted by the fossil fuel industry is introduced, basically saying, hey, you know, it's we don't consider that wrong because, hey, people bought what they were selling. It could get to that point. Who knows?
Well, so, look, we get this circumstance where now the judge in California has asked for a tutorial. This is, we think, one of the first times, to your point, Mariah, to the Kivalina case, which may or may not have introduced information. But now there is a discussion on record in a court. Evidently, the Exxon or one of the big oil companies essentially admits that climate change is real, but denies responsibility for it. Okay, all fine. But I think one of the interesting things I wanted to do was to go through pop quiz style and put you guys on the spot for a technical answer to the judge's 8 questions.
They're great. I have to say, they're some of them are amusing, and some of them are really good, solid scientific questions.
So let me. So these are not necessarily, can't necessarily answer these in detail, but we do. I certainly want to read out what the judge's questions were that were guiding this several hours of tutorial, right? Mm-hmm. And this would be like high school quiz show, right? First question was, what caused the various, so this is the judge's question to both the plaintiffs, which is the city of San Francisco and Oakland, and the oil companies. He asked them both to make the comment on what caused the various ice ages, including the quote-unquote little ice age and prolonged cool periods, and what caused the ice to melt. When they melted, by how much? What caused the ice ages to melt? And right, and when they melted, by how much did sea level rise? So basically, he's asking about ice, right? Mm-hmm. I get some answers, but do any of you guys want to take that for 10 points?
Well, the Vox article covered the answers, and it showed a picture of a spinning top, right, and talked about the Milankovitch cycle, which is the way that the Earth very slowly wobbles as it spins, and it changes where the sunlight hits so that it allows ice sheets to form or melt.
Right.
And that's what can cause sort of these shifts that cause different ice ages, ice melting and ice sheets.
Could I just jump in on that and say that
the
image in the Vox article, which we'll put a link to, is a spinning top. And every kid that's spun a top, eventually it's the top starts to wobble, right? So to the extent that the Earth is equivalent to a spinning top, the Earth can also wobble. But in the Earth's case, that wobbling takes 100,000 years or so. And as that wobbling happens, you get slightly different amounts of sunlight to different parts of the Earth. And that apparently is what triggers the, it's a positive feedback loop where all of a sudden this small change in the sunlight creates other effects that give us the ice ages. But that's, the reason I wanted Mariah to jump in is because when you say Milankovitch cycle, everyone gets freaked out, right? Because it's the sort of Russian name, sounds sciencey, and you know which way. It's like, well, what are they talking about? Really, it's just wobbling of the spinning top of the Earth, which happens on a 100,000-year cycle, and that's what caused the ice ages to come and go. And as the wobble, shall we say, leans back in towards the sun after 50,000 years ago, the ice age begins to reverse, right?
Yeah. So. Now, interestingly, it sounds like the Little Ice Age, which was a period of cooling in North America and Europe between 1300 and 1800, is different than that. It's not caused in the same way, and scientists are not totally sure what causes it, that it may be because of volcanic eruptions and a change in output from the sun. So the Little Ice Age is not as clear.
Right, and that's been the medieval warming period and the little ice ages are things that the deniers beat on all the time as this.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the relevant things about both of those events were they were localized. They were Northern
yep.
Europe. They weren't global events. They were things mm-hmm. that happened there. All right, so there's what you both get an A plus for that answer. Both of you. So
you too.
You're right at the head of the class. You're doing great. Okay, so second question. This one's a toughie. All right. What is the molecular difference by which carbon dioxide absorbs infrared radiation, but oxygen and nitrogen do not absorb infrared radiation? Of course, mm-hmm. just as before you guys jump in with your discussion of vibrational modes of the carbon dioxide molecule, the whole idea is that these greenhouse gases absorb the infrared, and the infrared is basically that red light that's warming your French fries at McDonald's, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're trapping that infrared light more preferentially with these greenhouse gases. So mm-hmm. do either of you guys want to take this on, or shall I? I mean,
well, basically the idea is that, you know, the molecules in CO2 can, as The Guardian puts it, they can bend and slow down solar radiation in a way that nitrogen and oxygen cannot. So therefore, you know, CO2 is much more of a danger in terms of trapping heat than nitrogen and oxygen are.
Exactly. And I think another way that I think about it is that the carbon dioxide is like one carbon and two oxygens, right? That's why it's dioxide. Mm-hmm. And that molecule makes a little kind of a V, right? So the two... It's not a straight line that the three molecules, there's the carbon in the middle and the two oxygens are like little legs, and those little legs can flop around in funny directions, and that is what allows the carbon dioxide to absorb the infrared, whereas things like oxygen and nitrogen have two identical things that oscillate against each other, and they, because of the way the thing works, they don't absorb any sunlight. Did I get that right, Professor Tinger?
That's right. I mean, it's almost like thinking of trying to catch a ball with a flat hand versus mm-hmm. trying to catch a ball with a cupped hand, right?
Okay.
If you try and catch a ball with a flat hand, it's going to bounce off. But if your hand is cupped, you're more likely to be able to hang on to it. And that's sort of what the CO2 does.
Ooh.
And the larger the molecule is, the more it can capture infrared.
Infrared, and of course the infrared is
heat.
The heating, is the radiation that is warm. Okay, we got to keep marching because we don't want to run out of time. The clock's ticking.
Mm-hmm.
This is the final. We're on to only question 3 out of 8, so we're going to have to speed up. What is the mechanism by which? Okay, here's the third question. What is the mechanism? I want you to imagine me in a judicial robe. What is the mechanism by which infrared radiation trapped by carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is turned into heat and finds its way back to sea level?
You know, we were a couple weeks ago, you know, we did the local toxic actions conference, and there's a great session where they talked about a heat trapping blanket as the best way to describe this phenomenon, where if you picture the earth wrapped in a blanket, you know, mm-hmm. and the infrared radiation acts as a blanket, which the heat can't get out of. You know, if you picture yourself in a sleeping bag, your heat radiates but doesn't leave.
So the heat from your body goes out, hits the sleeping bag, and then comes back to your body, basically, and keeps you nice and cozy.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's number 3. That's a check mark for Mariah. All right, here's number 4. Don't feel any pressure, DR, okay? I want you, you're at the head of the class. Does CO2 in the atmosphere reflect back any sunlight back into space, such that the reflected sunlight never penetrates the atmosphere in the first place? Does the CO2 reflect it back?
A tiny bit, but it's essentially insignificant, as the Guardian points out.
Right. It's basically, now, that's different from the aerosols we talked about a couple weeks ago, right? Little particles, mm-hmm. shiny little particles. Completely different story with that. Okay, all right. We go back to you, Mariah. Question 5. Here we go. Question 5. Apart from carbon dioxide, what happens to the collective heat from tailpipe exhaust, engine radiators, and all the other heat from the combustion of fossil fuels? How, if at all, does this collective heat contribute to warming of the atmosphere? I mean, the short answer there.
It's negligible. I mean, it doesn't do anything. Plain and simple, it's burning of fossil fuels. That's the heat that sticks around. The heat energy from
It's the sunlight that coming in. That's where it's the heat from the burning of fossil fuel from your fireplace it's just not that much of it. What's the thing about, you know, four hydrogen bombs every second or something that coming in from sunlight? I mean, the amount of energy coming in from sunlight so dwarfs the amount of heat generated by burning fossil fuels that is not really relevant. All right, that's question five. Let me get to question six. Oh boy, this is a long one.
Yeah. All right. It's basically.
In grade school, many of us were taught that humans exhale CO2, but that plants absorb CO2 and return oxygen to the air. That's why we like plants. Is this still valid? If so, why hasn't plant life turned the higher levels of carbon dioxide back into oxygen? Given that there's more, the increase in human population, up to 4 billion since the start of the Industrial Revolution, is human respiration, that is to say breathing, a contributing factor to the buildup of CO2? Who wants to answer that one?
DR, you're welcome to have at it. I just want to cite that, you know, the chief science advisor, Lamar Smith, right, is the one who said, well, we actually think that global warming is good for the earth. We think it's going to rejuvenate plant life, and we need more plants, and this is going to make agriculture boom. We had an episode. We talked about that a couple months ago. And, you know, the short answer is that it's not going to do all that much, many great things for agriculture the way that our chief scientific officer is suggesting, because he was not basing any of his suggestions on research.
Well, and you can, the way I answer that is that if you think of the famous, the Keeling curve, the Mauna Loa curve of the CO2, that has a little annual variation on top of this big rise. That little annual variation is all of the vegetation in the northern hemisphere growing in the springtime, and it only takes out a couple parts per billion of air of CO2 out of the air. So for plants to keep up with the huge amount of CO2 emitted from fossil fuel, they can't do it. It's not going to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, a lot of the plants we don't want to grow a bunch of are growing more, and the ones that we do want, you know, plants we might eat and so on and so forth are actually lower in nutritional content. I mean, there's a whole lot there. But, you know, the other question about if human respiration is contributing to the buildup of CO2, I think is amusing, but also a good question. I'm glad he's asking this, because this is, you know, debunks a lot of the sort of philosophies of deniers, right? You know, carbon dioxide is air. It's what we breathe, right, you know. Right, okay. But the amount of carbon dioxide humans breathe out is not going to affect things the way that burning fossil fuels does. But the other big point there is that humans are part of a closed carbon cycle, right? You know, we breathe air, but we, you know, we die, we go back into the earth, and then it goes
in. We eat food with carbon in it.
Right. It's a cycle. Whereas the fossil fuels are part of a, you know, this fossil fuels are carbon that's been locked away deep, deep, deep in the earth in the form of coal and oil. And we're digging that up. And this has been underground for millions of years. And we're pulling that up and burning it and putting it into the atmosphere in accumulating ways that are not part of a cycle at all.
Right.
And that's the problem.
All right. So now this next question, I want you to both answer in synchrony at the same time. Okay, or maybe all three of us will answer it together. The question from the judge is, what are the main sources of carbon dioxide that account for the incremental buildup of CO2 in the atmosphere? Say it together. Read my list. Fossil fuels. Okay, we don't have to go any more with that. Okay, last question. What are the main sources of heat that account for the incremental rise in the temperature of the earth?
Mm-hmm.
So this leads into a sort of a nuanced question about what I call forcing things. That is, what is trapping the heat? And the short answer is that carbon dioxide in the air is the main factor that's trapping the heat of the sun to warm the earth up. And so that's So there you go. Well, look, that we answered the judge's 8 questions in a mere 12 and a half minutes, whereas he allotted all these smart lawyer guys 2 hours to talk to him about it. And we could have saved him. He could have been driving down, crossing the Golden Gate Bridge, going back to his home in Marin by the time we could have got him out of court early. All right. Well, look, interesting questions. I think that this hearing has been held. You can probably see some, if you look online, you probably find some echoing of this, some discussion of the answers that were given to the judge. And it's an interesting long-term, one more step in the legal development of these court cases that relate to climate change and getting the truth into the public sphere, right? Mm-hmm. You both get, as I said, an A+, top of the class. Your science project won. You are both very good students. you can check out links. You can actually read the answers that Vox provided and that The Guardian provided and that a few other places provided to the judge's question on the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find that blog on our Facebook page. If you still trust Facebook, do you guys trust Facebook anymore? No.
Hesitating.
Yes. You can listen directly to our show on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud, etc., etc. You can find us on Apple Podcasts by searching for Massachusetts Climate Action. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Thanks for being here, Professor Tinger.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to everyone for listening to our, I hope, enlightening answers, but certainly, at least it, I hope our answers whetted your appetite to go out and get more succinct ones. Anyway, thanks everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.